Matthew Pipenberg, partner of Von Greyers AG and also author of Gold Matters. Welcome to the Competent Investor. Thanks for joining me today.
Oh, it's great to be back on a new and improved platform with you, and it's always a pleasure speaking with you, so I'm looking forward to it.
Well, I've been looking forward to it as well, Matt. You and I have had a lot of conversations, a lot of impactful conversations for myself over the years, and I'm very grateful for that, and always the chat outside the chat that we get to have.
Yeah, it's so true. They're usually longer than the interview, so that's good.
Yeah. Matt, I want to start today by talking about the idea of complexity. It seems that everywhere we look, we're adding complexity to systems, adding another layer of, so-called ease of use. Do you see this addition of complexity as being a deliberate way to maybe obfuscate the reality of our current systems or our current reality?
Oh, it's an interesting question. And I do think the complexity, I've written about how complexity can hide stupidity or even hide dishonesty. Some things, the derivative markets are complex. How central banks in general, the Federal Reserve works are complex. How the COMEX and the LBMA banks work, those are complex themes. And I think they're meant to be complex, especially derivatives. I remember sitting in an office in Barclays when I was a young hedge fund dragon slayer trying to understand a derivative product from a bunch of partners in the room. And it was in Manhattan and it had the paneled walls and the beautiful views and really smart Princeton grads with Harvard MBAs talking about their derivative trade and how we should invest in their strategy as part of our fund. And all of us sitting around the room, I think even the guy explaining the derivatives, the way they were using leverage and then hedging the leverage with swaps and then using credit and interest rate swap. And I considered myself not of average intelligence, but basic intelligence and semi-familiar with markets. And I didn't have the guts to say, I have no freaking clue for the last 30 minutes what you've been discussing at all and how this results in alpha and how there's really no risk. And I don't think anyone at the table was any different. Even the guy presenting, it was like a tax lawyer. If you're a tax lawyer, you can talk taxes. And if you're not a tax lawyer, you really don't know what questions to ask because it is meant to be so complex that you really can't find that rotten leaf in the tree that says there's a problem with this argument. It's just one example of a very, very complex instrument. But what was it really? It was uber leverage on a particular direction, on a particular asset, whether it was an interest rate, whether it was a credit instrument, or whether it was, well, it was basically, yeah, currency too. Those are the three main trades that you could use uber leverage on. And you use all this complexity to show a lot of Greek alphabet letters from a lot of great math classes at MIT or wherever these guys came from. And I'm sure they're very smart. I'm not saying that. I don't even think they were dishonest, but there was really no way to BS detect the product. And of course, Larry Summers, when he was the president of Harvard, when he later became undersecretary of the Treasury, he made fun of Brooks Lee Bourne, who was the CFTC head at the time, a Stanford grad, a female. And he said at Harvard, females weren't that good at math. But anyway, Brooks Lee Bourne was telling the world, these derivatives are kind of dangerous and complex, and they really should be regulated. And here comes Larry Summers, says, you don't understand. Bankers are sophisticated people. We know how to manage the risk in this space. It's just too complex for you. Don't worry. And you're about to bring down the banking system if you regulate derivatives. That was years before the great financial crisis. It was years before derivatives imploded the whole markets. It was years before derivatives imploded the Harvard endowment. So again, you have these really smart, smug people who think they understand the math and the complexity. They make it so complex that few people can question it. And then when it blows up, they're hiding in with their hands in their pockets and their heads down. And that's then the next story's on. A lot of this complexity, I think, hides. And this is where, throw the tinfoil hat on me. I've written about and I've spoken recently about derivatives and the Fed. And I said the plumbing is meant to be complex. It's meant for the average intelligent person who has another job and kids and a mortgage and other things on their mind to really not dig into and fully understand. And I think there is some intentionality behind that. And sometimes the rug gets pulled from them. People forget the arrogance of Larry Summers, the wisdom of Brooks Lee Bourne years ago, because it's an old headline, but it was trillions in counterparty risk. It brought down the US markets. It had a contagion effect throughout the world. It cost $27 trillion to fix. It affected people on the streets. So these little weapons of mass destruction were important. how how those things were built and constructed does matter. The leverage behind it does matter. I just said it's gambling masquerading as banking. And in a way, it's kind of like a little tech mafia, a little applied math mafia that creates these things at banks. And again, we won't get into a tutorial on derivatives, which would make everyone's eyes roll, and I probably wouldn't even do a good job. But as I've said recently, and I wrote recently, look at Lehman Brothers. I knew Jimmy Cain. I mean, look, he didn't even go to college, but he was a brilliant mind. He was a bridge champion. He had a fast mind. And before the great financial crisis, he was telling the world, we're good. We've got 600 billion balance sheet of assets and liabilities. They're perfectly matched. Don't worry. Yeah, we have some MBS. MBS was mortgage-backed securities. And in particular, there's a lot of subprime mortgage-backed securities. But the rule was these mortgages never default and we're fine. What he didn't say and what the world didn't see off the balance sheet is, yeah, you had 600 billion in assets and liabilities, but you had 35 trillion exposure in mortgage-backed securities. When I say exposure, notional exposure, they didn't actually own any of those mortgage-backed securities. They were using 101 leverage. So you could have a $100 million play on a mortgage pool, but you only have $1 million of actual ownership of that. In other words, it's just massive leverage. That's gambling when the house thinks they can win. And it works as long as the direction of your trade works. But of course, mortgages aren't too big to fail. There was an uh-oh moment in subprime. Lehman went, off the battlefield, carried off on its shield. It had a contagion effect to Bear Stearns and many other banks and AIG, et cetera. We don't need to get into every wonky weed, but it was basically a levered gamble that went wrong and it brought down the banking system, which we had to bail out. But I think what's even more disappointing and disturbing about levering products and calling them incredibly complex, safe derivatives is that that was in 2008 a $60 trillion mistake for the world. And it cost, again, almost 29, 25 to 29 billion to bail out. That was through the Fed, through TARP, and through other central banks around the world to kind of stop the bleeding caused by that derivative complex plumbing. But we then fast forward to today, 2025. You would think that after that embarrassing moment in the history of capital markets, that we'll never have a 208 moment, that we'll never have derivatives or leverage. Again, it's a complex world, it's complex instruments, but we won't do that again. And we created Dodd-Frank to centralize the clearing of derivatives. And we had, I think it was Obama signing a bill, and it made it look very safe. Now we've controlled these gamblers with PhDs or MBAs overpaid, overbonused at banks where the money is just extraordinary because of the leverage when it works for you. But we'll never have that mistake again. Again, as of today, we have over 600 trillion in derivative exposure globally, and 90% of that is in four US banks. And again, this is Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, Citi, and B of A. And you take an example of a smart bank, Jamie Dimon, smart banker, understands risk. It's just an example. They have an equity capital of about 200 billion, and they have total assets of about 2.4 trillion. So we're looking at 2.6 trillion in real value. But their notional exposure in derivatives is 54 trillion. So 54 trillion against 2.6 trillion in actual capital and assets. Of course, that's the same kind of ratio of extreme leverage that you see at B of A and other banks. Most of it's in these US too big to fail banks that are bailed out by the Fed and the taxpayer when there is an uh-oh moment. And as I've joked, they're behaving as if everything's priced to perfection, that there is no real risk, that these are instruments for hedging. But you don't need 54 trillion in a hedge bet. You don't need that kind of risk. And you can't explain how difficult that is unless you're Brooks Lee born at the CFTC, unless you have applied math backgrounds, unless you've actually traded these instruments. No one's going to really know where the Achilles heel is. I'm trying to simplify it, but the Achilles heel, whether it's in interest rates or currencies or credit swaps, the Achilles heel is if the bet you're making is wrong and your gross exposure is a little bit too big to cure if there's an uh-oh moment and you've just made the wrong bet. And the problem with all these too big to fail banks and their massive trillion, multi-trillion dollar leverage in derivatives is they're mostly in the same direction. And they're mostly making the same assumptions about interest rates, currencies, and credits. And they're mostly correct for most of the time, but they're playing a game of chicken with the laws of physics and the laws of mean reversion and the black swan realities that come. It only takes one bad day of weather in their markets, in their ocean voyage, to have an uh-oh moment. I mean, you do motocross. You can be an extremely capable motocross guy. You can be an incredibly talented athlete and still get a flat tire at high speed on the wrong road and be the best driver on earth and still have a very dangerous moment. You know, I'm a wanker polo player. You can be a very good polo player. You can be going 35 miles an hour down a field and you can have a horse trip and roll over you. It happened to me last September. In other words, things can go wrong. There's uh-oh moments. My father-in-law sailed around the world twice. Some of the best sailors passed him on the way to the Indian Ocean. They drowned because there was a storm. In other words, you can't be so arrogant to assume that there's no risk or that you can contain risk when you're looking at 54 trillion in derivative exposure in one bank. That is hubris to a fault to me. And so again, that's an example of complex plumbing. The Federal Reserve is very complex. Excess reserves, interest on excess reserves, QE, QT, you know, what are they doing? How do they really create this money? Why do we have 12 12 different reserve banks, and who's in the board of governors, and how does this thing really work? Is it federal? Is it a reserve? Does it work for us? Is it independent? It's so complex, and yet it's really very simple. The Federal Reserve is a private bank, and its shareholders are other private banks. It's a corporation. It has nothing to do with the Fed. It's not federal, and it's not even a reserve. If you look at its balance sheet, it's on Constitution Ave, and it's not even constitutional. I mean, these are dramatic statements, but if you really dig into the weeds, you'll see this. And you'll see again, and I won't get into a history of the Federal Reserve or the creature from Jekyll Island. It's so simple, it is like a cartel. It is like a racket of private bankers that scared the hell out of Woodrow Wilson in December of 2013 when he signed this Federal Reserve Act into law. And the rumor is that it was the darkest day in his life, the darkest day for America. That's the debatable statement, but it was, because what it did is it created a massive power transfer from DC to the Fed, from politics to a central bank, a private central bank. And it also created a massive wealth transfer from the insiders, the elites, to the man on the street. Because now a private bank, a private corporation, which gives a dividend to other private banks, which are the shareholders of this bank, has complete control over the supply and price of US money. That is a massive power. But what's even more astounding that no one knows, since we've gone off the gold standard, I mean, I don't even, if you have a dollar bill or a $20 bill, it just says reserve note. It's a credit. It's an IOU from Uncle Sam, this dollar. But the Fed can create it at will, literally with a mouse click at the Eccles building. If they need a couple hundred billion, they'll literally type in a couple hundred billion, hit enter, it's on the balance sheet, and they can give it to the Treasury to buy their US IOUs. Uncle Sam's debt can be monetized by a bank that can create money out of thin air. That's not an exaggeration. It's a simplification of something very complex. But what's astounding is and this is what no one really talks about in civics or an MBA program at any school in America or in the West, is where does the Fed get that money? It gets that money from nowhere, and it gets a return on it. It gets an interest return on that you pay, and the Uncle Sam pays indirectly. It's complex, but they get a return for money they create out of thin air. So Uncle Sam is beholden to the Fed. You and I are beholden to the Fed if we're taxpayers in the US. But who is the Fed, this beast, beholden to when it creates money? It's beholden to no one. No one. I
They
mean,
do it. They
that
do it
is,
ex nihilo.
it's exactly ex nihilo. It is literally the best racket in town, and no one knows how it works. So again, that's just the Federal Reserve System. It's very similar in the Bank of England, the Bank of Japan, the People's Bank of China, how these things actually work, the control that is held in this small minority. And who are the beneficiaries? Their nieces and nephews on Wall Street, the big, too big to fail banks that are too important. And that's why we were bailing them out. So it is an insider trade. And I've said, I don't know if I said on this show, I was at a fancy party in New York in 2014. I won't say the name of this person. He was very high up in government and in this world. And I was talking about that was when QE had become out of control. We'd gone from QE1 to 2 to 3. I said, this isn't sustainable. And he looked me in the eye and he said, it doesn't matter whether we're right. All that matters is we're on the inside. I'll never forget that. That was like an epiphany when I became an apostate of all things Wall Street, which was my home, which is what benefited me, which is what got me the deal at Goldman Sachs to get an IPO. I learned how the sausage was made. It's certainly profitable, but it's not moral. It's certainly complex. It's meant to be, but it's also very simple. It's a racket. And that sounds like a blasphemy or a sensational clickbait thing to say. But when I learned how the Fed worked and I learned how people who are in that space think, They do make Faustian deals with themselves once they become Federal Reserve governors or presidents. There are exceptions. There are great exceptions, like Thomas Herndon. I think he's a very moral and ethical guy. He also vetoed half the things that came under the Bernanke regime. But guys like Greenspan, who believed in sound money, wrote about sound money, believed in gold, wrote about gold, the moment they became politicized, they lost some of their ethics, you know, and this goes back to, I think, Charles Goodwin in the 70s, is the moment you become political, you become dishonest. And that's true of growth rates, GDP rates, Federal Reserve practices, unemployment statistics from the BLS. They become politicized and they literally become dishonest. In this case, if you're on the inside and you're profiting and you're on the boards of different banks and you're getting a good resume, you don't care if that's good for the world as long as it's good for you. To me, that's not representation of anything healthy in capitalism or free markets. It's not a free market. It's not real capitalism. So those are just examples in the derivative market or in the Fed market or in the Fed kind of history that if you take the time, and it's hard to take the time to dig into the weeds, you can fact check what I've said in sensational generalizations. Again, I'm trying to simplify. It's the same with the LBMA banks, and in particular, the COMEX, which makes up its own rules as it goes along. You know, WikiLeaks, Peter Embro, this came out years ago. But when you put futures contracts on the gold price to manipulate the price, that's artificial price, you know, manipulation. That should be illegal. Just like the Fed's job is basically counterfeit money production, that should be illegal. But once you regulate it and put a band-aid of some imprimatur of something official or something Wall Street on it, you hide the fact that it's just uber leverage by a handful of banks that can literally control the price of gold and silver, because the price of gold and silver, if left to natural price discovery, would be too high, and that would embarrass the government's fiat currency. So there was a deliberate attempt to manipulate gold and silver, which we can get into, but I'm saying that's not a conspiracy theory. That's a fact if you understand futures contracts, the hedging that goes on at this COMEX OTC market, which is off the counter, off the regulation ballot boards, and basically self-regulated and self-fulfilling. This isn't an extreme statement. It's a game. It's a casino game where the house basically fixes the rules. Again, we can talk about how that works. It's a sensational statement, but if you really, really look at it, it's very, very obvious. Again, trying to do in 20 minutes, simplify complex things like derivatives, like the LBMA or the COMEX, or like how the Federal Reserve or central banks work, it takes years of being in that space to see it. Just like if you're like Jimi Hendrix, it took years of studying music to really riff, to go off and just be spontaneous. But you have to do the homework first, and then you see how it all comes together. You know, Picasso did some really abstract paintings with cubes, but before he did those cubism, he was an incredible portrait painter. He was an incredible landscape painter. He could do the details with the brushstrokes, but then he could see the bigger picture and be creative. When you spend 20 or 30 years in Wall Street and you look at how leverage works, when you look at how the Fed works, when you look at how the COMEX works, you see the game. You see it. It doesn't mean that everyone in it is immoral or everyone in it is bad. But at the top of that pyramid is an insider trade. It's good to be on the inside. It has nothing to do with being right or wrong. And you could stretch that metaphor out to just about everything when it comes to regulatory bodies or political bodies. And that's why it's very easy for me at 55 to be very cynical about just about everything I see. It's official. But it doesn't make it any more dangerous or less dangerous for the average citizen. I'm not asking them to all go out and read the history of derivatives or the Federal Reserve or the LBMA banks. But they need to be more and more informed, or at least more critical and questioning. They're relatively powerless to protect themselves from this, but there are certain assets or certain strategies that they can do a little better. For example, if your central bank isn't going to protect your fiat money for you by going back to the Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, and make it redeemable in a hard asset like gold, if they're not going to do that for you, as our founding fathers begged us to do, and we reneged in 1971 for the last time, then you have to do that for yourself. And don't think that's just a gold bug argument from a gold bug executive. If I were still trading stocks and bonds, I'd still say the same thing. And more importantly, there are plenty of guys who are trading stocks and bonds, like Jeffrey Gundlach, who thinks you should have a 25% allocation to gold. So it's not just the gold buggers. He's the bond king, and he sees what's happening in currencies. Jamie Dimon of J.P. Morgan sees a very easy $10,000 gold price. Michael Hartnett of BofA says you should have 20% gold in your portfolio. Morgan Stanley, 60-40, is now 60-20-20 portfolio. Even the whales, the insiders, or the smart guys that aren't in the gold camp are saying the exact same thing that we in the gold camp have been saying for years. If your central bank won't protect the purchasing power of your currency, do it yourself. That doesn't mean you have to have 100% of all your assets in gold. So again, it's taking the complex, getting some critical thinking, having a little cynicism, and doing for yourself, in one example only, just in the gold case, of backing your own currency with your own gold if you can, because your so-called fiduciaries in DC are not doing it for you. That's a long, long answer to a simple question on simplicity and complexity. I'm sorry, but I got off on it. But it's, go ahead, do your homework yourself on how derivatives work, how the Fed works, how the LBMA works. It will astound you. And question, but we can all feel the crime of currency debasement. It's even called the debasement trade now. We can all feel the misreported inflation. We can all feel the distrust, left or right, of so-called full employment data, which we can get into as well. It's simply empirically, objectively not accurate. And I think that is sensational. I wouldn't say it if I didn't believe it, and I wouldn't say it if I couldn't back it up with some data, which we can spend hours on. But it is intentionally complex, and that complexity hides a lot of dishonesty, and it's meant to, because good citizens either trust, as they should, trust their governments. That's not naive, it's sweet almost. And good citizens want to believe what they're told. And I'm not saying that everyone in private or public office in finance or politics is dishonest, but I'm saying a lot of the power behind this complexity is dishonesty. And check it out for yourself in a sense. But yeah, I'm pretty disappointed by it. And after 30 years in Wall Street and watching these systems implode in real time because of just completely negligent, self-interested drunk driving at the financial level, just appalling to me.
Well, to your point, Matt, the idea of having basically the price of gold and silver kind of controlled, there was I can't remember the exact Fed chair, but he said, we didn't do enough to control the price of gold at that time, and that's what ended up making them look bad, right?
Look, I mean, there's a lot of books written about this too. I mean, when we went off the gold standard, which was such a pivotal moment for so many reasons. I mean, first of all, we'd gone on and off the gold standard in times of crisis, certainly during the Civil War and the Resumption Acts. And these were emergency measures, which I guess you could justify. The Civil War, for God's sakes, was a time for the greenback to not be supported by gold. You could understand that. But again, we went back onto a gold standard. Then there were some constitutional cases about having treasuries backed by gold, which is now, by the way, making headlines with Judy Shelton. But basically, our Constitution, our forefathers said sound money is the basis for a sound society, because once you start getting into paper money or fiat money, there is no chaperone to your spending. There is no chaperone to your greed and your instinct to stay in power by overpromising and then delivering through deficit spending, which is the MO of DC politics, left or right. That became open and obvious post-Nixon, post-71, which he said, by the way, would be temporary. It's 54 years later. It's not temporary. Because what politician wouldn't want an unfettered checkbook? And what wouldn't want a Fed that can create money for nothing for you? Yes, it debases the currency, it hurts the man on the street, but it keeps you in power. And as long as most people don't notice the invisible inflation and the credit expansion that leads to currency debasement that follows that, as they're not supposed to because it's not taught in school, then they get away with it for decades until it becomes a boiling point or a tipping point where the boiling water now starts to really boil. And that's where we are in 2023, 24, 25. We are empirically there. But I think, to your question, I think the price of gold was their biggest fear from 71 on. And there's books about this. Right after Nixon made that announcement in August of 71, and they went back into his office, do you think the Americans will buy this? Will they figure this out? They promised that gold would go down in price and the dollar would stay just as strong. Gold went up at 8,000%, literally 8,000% from then to today. And so that was just a lie. It wasn't temporary. It's still in play 54 years later. And they said the dollar would get stronger. In the first decade after 1971, the dollar in absolute, not relative purchasing power, lost 75%. And against gold, it's lost 99%. So all of that was dishonest. It was dishonest from the moment it was said. It was complex. It couldn't be seen right away. So it was an easy political statement. And for the 54 years since, every party that comes into the White House, red or blue, has been debasing the currency and deficit spending and having the Fed cover the delta with mouse click money. That is just a fact. And it's not just QE that creates inflation, because it's a little wonkier than that. It gets wonkier, but it's credit expansion. And this is what Richard Verner and others have made it very clear. Credit expansion is money supply expansion. And it's not that credit is not being used for productivity, it's being used for consumption. So it's misspending of credit expansion and dollar debasement. It's the perfect storm. I don't think a lot of politicians, Biden, Clinton, Trump, Obama, were ever that savvy in economics or economic theory to even know that they were making these mistakes. They didn't want to look at it, but they were clearly making these mistakes and were paying for it now. But again, going back to the gold price back in 71, everyone would come into the White House every day, Treasury Secretary, Fed Chairman, the White House. What was their one question? What was the thing that scared them the most? What's the gold price doing? We just decoupled from gold. We just promised the world the dollar would get stronger and gold would get weaker. We know that's a lie. What's the gold price doing? And the way they solved that was just a few years later, they added futures contracts to the COMEX so that a handful of banks could put, 4% gold and 90% paper shorts on gold to force that gold price down every morning at 8:30, 9:30. You just saw this wave of shorts putting their boot to the neck of the natural price discovery of gold. It kept gold down. What's happening in 2025, since November of 2024 to today, is there's money, the free float of gold is leaving the COMEX. There's tons coming in and tons going out. But since November of 24, you've seen record inflows and outflows. And my whole career, COMEX was a net exporter. Now it's a net importer. But as soon as that gold is imported, it's leaving the COMEX because some counterparty, we don't know who, is wanting to keep that gold for themselves. They don't want to keep shorting the gold price because they can't. They'd rather have the physical gold. And now we're seeing gold rising at astronomical levels in such a short period of time because COMEX, whether it's silver or gold, doesn't have the same power to lever because they don't have enough gold in their account to use leverage against it. It's complex, but it's very simple. They just don't have the toys anymore to keep playing the way they were playing in the past because everyone's bringing that gold back into their own zip codes, into their own vaults. And the free float last December was zero. I mean, the available gold on the COMEX was zero. So again, but people are probably listening, Matt, what the heck is the COMEX? What's going on in the COMEX? I get it. They're not supposed to know this stuff. It's not in the New York Times. It's not in the Wall Street Journal. There isn't a 60-minute special on it because it's very detrimental to national security if the average citizen knew that gold, to your question, was their biggest concern. It's gotten out of control. They don't want gold to go too high in the early 70s, so they price fixed it through the COMEX by 74. Brilliant. Very brilliant move on their part. But now the jig is up because the COMEX, the game at the COMEX, as Andy Shechtman has done so well and many others have said, that is openly deteriorating. It's openly deteriorating because after so many decades, the jig is up on the dollar, the currency, fiat debasement, and the gold is no longer a contrarian asset. It is a necessary and strategic asset. It is so important now that even the COMEX and the LBMA can't keep it on their desk long enough because counterparties now see that there's a shift in the world and they need their gold more than a US Treasury, a US dollar, a euro, a bund, or a gilt. Because all of these countries that are issuing IOUs are quantifiably, objectively broke. And that's becoming more understood. And the man on the street doesn't need to understand LBMA, inflation reports, sovereign bonds. They know the inflation when they take the GW Bridge or they pay tuition or they get, God forbid, they get a medical bill that isn't fully insured. They know the cost of things is going up, regardless of what the CPI scale says, which is an open fiction. So again, all these things are connected. All of these things are ultimately dishonest mechanizations. What's amazing about gold is for the first time since 74, it is being more honest. Gold is holding its value better than these currencies and these sovereign credits. And now it's rising because these price-fixing beasts in New York and London don't work the way they did for the last 30, 40, 50 years because now gold is in such demand that there just isn't enough of it to manipulate. And it's fascinating. It's the same in the silver trade. I mean, I could spend an hour on the silver trade. It's very complex in the LBMA markets, the free float in silver. There just isn't any silver there. It's T plus one, and you're supposed to get your silver the next day. It's like T plus 8 weeks. They don't have the silver. They've got like 50 million ounces. That's nothing. It's literally tapped out. And again, sounds sensational. Your average water cooler conversation at your average job in America or the average trip on the golf course isn't what's the free float on the silver market in the LBMA. It's meant to be off the radar. It's meant to be ignored. It's meant not to be discussed or understood. But if people actually saw the plumbing, how it works, they'd be nervous. Or as Henry Ford, not the best man, but as Henry Ford said, if people knew how the Federal Reserve actually worked or how the banking system worked, there'd be revolution. So I'm not making this up. Yeah, I'm pretty jaded. Yes, there's still hope for the world. It's not the end of America, the dollar. Yes, there's still hope. to invest in this backdrop, but this is where gold, yeah, I'm a gold bug. Yes, I'm biased. This is where gold is such a central theme right now. We've seen this. Egon has seen this for 20 years. I've understood it for the last 10. But again, bond men, portfolio managers, and equities, you'd be surprised who our clients are. A lot of these guys who weren't talking about gold publicly are buying gold now, just like the central banks are in the East, just like the COMEX outflows are confirming. Gold is no longer that analog pet rock. It is a strategic monetary metal in a monetary system that's completely changing right before our eyes. And it's fascinating to watch. It's fascinating to be a part of this history.
On the other side of that, though, Matt, when we're talking about the way that the gold market works right now, what are the, let's say, the productive uses of futures markets? You know, we talk about this in such a negative way, but this does serve a purpose to be able to hedge costs for some producers, right?
I mean, look.
Producers or minters, you know, there's I just want to be balanced about the nuance of understanding this.
Look, my hometown of Stevensville, Michigan, is also the hometown of David Stockman, who was a congressman and then was part of Reagan's budgetary commission or Office of Budgetary Management or something. He wrote a book many years ago, probably 10 years ago, called The Great Deformation. He's an honest broker, in my opinion. He's a good Midwestern politician who actually can speak very eloquently about Wall Street and about futures markets in a way that people understand. And he, you know, Stevensville, Michigan is a farm town. My baseball field literally had corn stalks. It was like, you know, that movie with Kevin Costner. I mean, literally, it was cornfields and baseball. And I think it creates good people like David Stockman. And the futures market was in the Merc, the Chicago Exchange, this kind of dusty office in Chicago with cobwebs and a few chairs and desks, was created to help farmers. In other words, if you were growing soy or corn, or you had pork bellies, and you were worried about bad weather this winter, or you were worried you couldn't control maybe the supply chain of grain, and it might affect your crops, or it might affect your cattle or your pigs, that you wanted to kind of hedge your bets by, you know, buying a contract, fixing a paper price on your pork bellies or your corn, so that if it was a bad winter, you at least had a fixed price. And if the prices went down, you had a fixed price in the futures market, so you weren't ruined. And if it was a great winter and a great season, and you would have made more money without that futures price, well, you know, it's better safe than sorry. We want to have basic clarity so none of the farmers get beaten down by an uh-oh moment, is that we were talking about. Uh-oh moments exist. And that Merc exchange was really an honest exchange to help farmers basically protect themselves. What happened in the 70s, and David Stockman does a brilliant narrative, he tells a great story. You get young Turks, a young Leo Malamed, a young Milton Friedman, a young Alan Greenspan, who said, I got an idea. Let's add super leverage in the futures market to just about every asset. And it went, so the Merc or the futures market went from being a sober, necessary hedge against risk for farmers into a casino for Wall Street to speculate on anything, literally use leverage on anything. So, to your point, there is a role for futures markets, for price fixing, for setting agreed upon contractual obligations to set a price, to keep volatility controlled in something as important as agriculture, the things that feed us, the things that make America great. But when you get three guys like Malamud in particular, Greenspan and Friedman in the room, and adding leverage to everything, including the Merc, that's when the deformation, the great deformation, really started. And again, I recommend that book by David Stockman. Just a clarion in the fog, a light in the fog of trying to make sense of that. Because yes, to your point, futures used wisely make sense. Contracts used wisely make sense. Even leverage within a certain limit makes sense. But what we did, or what they did to the futures market decades ago, and for the sins of which we're still paying for now, post 2008 and coming, you can find the patient zero of that in just a few figureheads. But of course, Wall Street drank that idea. Why not? Let's just use super leverage. Because if we're right, the returns are off the charts. If we're right. And if we're wrong, we'll call it an extraneous event, a black swan. We'll confuse the masses with some bad guy. We'll blame it on something that's not our control. Long-term capital management had two Nobel laureates on its board, and they still blew up the markets. So leverage is a dangerous, dangerous, addictive sin on Wall Street. And the derivatives markets that we talked about earlier is an example, but the futures market is just where it's gotten out of control. And again, the Great Deformation answers that question better than I do, but it's really worth a read. It's a thick book, but it's a great read.
Matt, when we think about this, adding this complexity and these layers of leverage, any of the things that we've touched on today, obviously, when the rubber starts to hit the road here of these, for example, the liquidity issues that the repo market is starting to run into, do you think that adding this layer of tokenization, another layer of complexity, is just the next system, the next step to propagate and prop up that system of leverage and derivatives?
Again, it is a brilliant crime, and it is, I have to give credit to the Genius Act. It is in some ways genius because if you really look at how it works, it's quite brilliant. It is a very desperate act, and it has a lot of parallels to the Fed. In other words, getting their money for nothing and their mandate for free. Because if you look at what stablecoin really is, and you can't blame them. It stems from the fact, basically, as simple as this, since 2022, when we weaponized the world reserve currency, the US dollar, the US Treasury, against a major nuclear power like Russia, whatever you think of Russia, that the world lost faith in that neutral reserve asset. It's the de-dollarization, the BRICS, all these stories came from that moment. There has been a lessening interest in US Treasury since 2014 in general. That accelerated profoundly in 2022. And the world was already dumping treasuries in 2014 after QE4 got out of control and trust in the dollar started to get questioned. It accelerated when we weaponized that dollar at the height of a massive debt spiral. So the world doesn't trust the US Treasury and the US dollar, and now it's weaponized. So DC has a problem. It has a dollar that is unloved and untrusted. They need to find synthetic demand for that dollar. Enter stablecoin. And the narrative of stablecoin is, if you're a struggling physician in Istanbul or Czechoslovakia or some part of the world and you want a dollar as opposed to some other local currency, you want the king dollar, you can get an e-dollar, which is app super fast, super efficient, super transferable. And all you got to do is give us a dollar and we'll redeem it for an e-dollar and you win. You get this e-dollar. What they don't say is you give the issuer of the e-dollar, which is Circle Internet or JP Morgan, it's fintech or private banks or commercial banks. Well, they get your dollar and then they invest it. They have to, by law, invest it in US treasuries. So for Uncle Sam, this is a great way to create synthetic demand for dollars and US treasuries. It's great because you sell this e-dollar thing as this great, efficient, modern technology. You get it. And Uncle Sam gets a buyer indirectly of US treasuries, which nobody else wants. And fintech and JP Morgan get to invest your dollar in US treasuries by law and keep the yield, keep the return, get the return. So basically, if you're a buyer of an e-dollar, you're basically buying US treasuries but getting no yield. You're getting nothing for your dollar. You get to just have an e-dollar. But fintech gets to arbitrage that and buy US treasuries. And by the way, what is Circle Internet buying? What is Tether buying? They're buying gold and Bitcoin with the money they're making. But it's an insider trade. It was a kingmaker. The Genius Act was a kingmaker. By the way, even if they use excess reserves to buy more stable coins, and yes, there's 185 billion stable coin dollars out there. I mean, it's making a lot of money for Circle Internet and JP Morgan, et cetera, or Tether. But really, it's a kingmaker for them because they get the interest, but the end user just gets an e-dollar. They don't get any yield. They don't get any return. That's for the bank and the fintech companies. And Uncle Sam gets an artificial demand. But even if they create a bigger market for these stable coins to buy US treasuries and make Circle Internet even richer and make JP Morgan even fatter, it's not enough demand for US treasuries and US dollars to solve a $38 trillion public debt level at DC level. And the CBO says we're going to be at $50 trillion by 2033. So whatever Band-Aid solution stablecoin does do for Uncle Sam, regardless of the profits it makes for Circle Internet and others, it's still not going to solve the debt crisis that we have. It's still a guppy solution to a whale of a debt problem. But it is absolutely a fantasy to think that stablecoin is going to save Uncle Sam's debt crisis. What it really is a kingmaker for fintech and banks, and a sucker builder for e-dollar buyers. It's a sucker builder. It's a sucker builder. But, again, if I'm the president, I see the writing on the wall, I need some demand somewhere for this dollar. I get it. Let's call it the Genius Act. Let's call it efficient. And by the way, that stablecoin is just as trackable and programmable as central bank digital currency. It's just issued by fintech and commercial banks, not a central bank. But if you don't think fintech and commercial banks are just as much in bed with the Fed as they are, then you're naive. It's still central bank digital currency by another name. I'm sorry, it is. You're still programmable and trackable. You're still that truck driver in Canada. It says or does the wrong thing. It's very easy to seize that e-dollar, much easier than that dollar was in a Folgers can. So please, there's a lot of things wrong with stablecoin, but I get why it was created. It's quite brilliant, just like the LBMA market and COMEX markets are quite brilliant, just like derivatives are quite brilliant, but they're destructive. They're not what they say they are. Just like quantitative easing isn't what it says it is. Just like the Patriot Act isn't what it says it is. Nothing is what it says it is. And the Genius Act isn't really that genius. But again, for your average guy on the street, understanding that takes a heck of a lot of time. And to just take my word for it takes a heck of a lot of trust. So I get the skepticism. I get the cynicism that people who are facing the invisible tax of inflation, who are facing increased centralization and more control, I get why they're frustrated because they don't know who to believe. Certainly not Matt Pipenberg in Zurich, as opposed to Donald Trump in DC or some, genius at JP Morgan. They must be right. After all, they're in power. But don't trust these guys. They're not always doing what's best for you. Again, I can't blame the administration, though, for trying to come up with something to deal with this debt crisis, whether it's Doge or USAID or stablecoin or even gold revaluation. But stablecoin is intentionally complex. The Loomis Act and all these things behind it have a lot of hidden, I guess, provisions that you're not meant to fully grasp. And there's a lot of rot beneath the wings of those so-called salvation models. But I do understand that in this debt spiral that America is facing, which they created on their own, that there is an effort from one executive order after the next to try and put the finger in the dike somewhere, find a solution somewhere. You got to give him credit for that, or the administration credit for that. Bessent, Trump talking about gold revaluation, Judy Shelton talking about a gold-backed treasury. These are all desperate acts to try and bring down some of this debt. The reshoring of jobs, which I'm all in favor of, I absolutely agree. These are solutions we need to be talking about. This administration is talking about, but reshoring jobs is going to take more than tariffs to do. Frankly, if I wanted to reshore jobs, I'd put a tax on CEOs that have offshored labor to China and Central America and make them pay for the reshoring of the jobs, not the rest of the world. That's just my opinion. But because big government is so in bed with big corporations, they won't do that. They'll do the External Revenue Service, try to win the hearts and minds of the rest of the world by putting tariffs on them and then asking them to buy US treasuries is not going to work. So that's just my view. It's a real pickle, but I will say at least this administration, as Trump would say, is doing more than Sleepy Joe. At least they're trying to do things. But what I'm saying is it's not going to be enough. It isn't enough. And that's why we're seeing the DXY at 99. That's why we're seeing the BIS give gold a tier one status. It's why central banks now own more physical gold than they do US treasuries. It's why gold has gone from 2,000 to 4,000 in 18 months. It's why gold is making headlines. It's not a risk asset trade like Nvidia. It's part of a new monetary system that's changing right in front of our eyes. And very few people understand the plumbing behind that too, because again, it's very complex.
Matt, is there any way to kind of sidestep this complexity by going to that basic layer of physical gold for the average person?
Again, for the average person, $4,000 an ounce is a lot of freaking money, right? $4,000 an ounce. A year ago, it was almost half that. A few years ago, it was at 1,600. Even when it was at 1,600, for the average American from Stevensville, Michigan, or Cleveland, Ohio, $1,600 is a lot of money. I mean, literally, 20% of Americans are considered subprime right now. 20%. Another 20% literally have to take a second job to pay for anything besides rent, just to have food and maybe one Vikings game a year to take their kids to. If you take your kids to a Red Sox game, you better be working for a hedge fund because the tickets are way too expensive for the average guy on the street. So, yeah, I keep saying, well, if your central banks can't protect you from the fraud of your federal government or your Federal Reserve, protect yourself by backing up your own paper money with a real store of value like physical gold. Well, that's great, Matt, but I don't have enough money to buy an ounce of physical gold. And that's the hard part. That's the sad part. What advice do I have then for you? And I respect that. I came from a family that couldn't afford physical gold either when I was growing up. So what do you do? That's the real pickle. I can say you can afford a gram. You can try and do an ounce a year. But if it goes from 2,000 an ounce to 4,000 an ounce in 1 year, you're constantly feeling like you can't protect yourself. So I want to respect that question. The more positive answer I have for that, for people who really are counting every penny, which is most Americans, 2/3 of Americans live paycheck to paycheck. So they need better advice than, hey, I'm sorry, gold's too expensive. I think the real opportunity for those folks, and who I would say need to hear this, and it is my bias, is silver, because silver is grotesquely undervalued vis-a-vis gold. And for a lot of reasons, I think silver is not the poor man's gold. I say it over and over. It is the smart man's silver. I think even the most struggling families at $50 or $54 or $60 an ounce silver, wherever it's going to get higher, in my opinion, not my guarantee, for a lot of reasons we can get into, and we should, because I think silver is the answer for most normal citizens of the world that is an affordable way to protect them from the dying purchasing power of their fiat currency, whether that's a euro or a Canadian or Australian or American dollar, et cetera. You still can, I think, afford silver or make the sacrifices to start buying some silver, because I think silver historically is ready for a major, major vertical move up, because the supply and demand just doesn't make sense for silver. And the control of the silver price in London and New York is becoming less powerful. And so silver will have free price discovery, and it will make moves faster than gold. It will protect your purchasing power better than paper currency, because silver is still a monetary metal. It has industrial uses too. It's still a monetary metal with industrial demand. And I think silver is an opportunity. It's a short way of answering your question. And I can get into the reasons why I think silver will go up, but I think silver is an affordable solution for those that can't afford an ounce of gold at a time. But a gram of gold is affordable. Finding the right local dealers and getting the right premiums is difficult for many people. But I think silver is something, whether you're a billionaire or barely getting by, silver is a great investment. And I think the man on the street can afford some silver.
In the case where we've seen silver spike, Matt, we can look back at the 1980s or 2001 as these examples of when silver got up to this $50 level that we're actually enjoying for a while now. How realistic is it to think that we can capture an appreciation like that in what is a very volatile, historically a very volatile asset?
Listen, and Egon is absolutely right. Silver is not for widows and orphans. It will create more volatility than most people want to stomach. And we should talk about that. Even that great bull run in precious metals, and certainly in gold from 1971 to 1980, where gold went up 21x. Well, silver went up 24x. In other words, I've always said it's that little speedboat next to the juggernaut, or that battleship that is gold. When gold is in a bull market, which it is just beginning to be, it now is, that little speedboat can certainly outpace that battleship. When you start to get headwinds or rough seas, the juggernaut of gold or the battleship of gold can handle that a lot better than silver, which bounces around and is more dangerous. But anyone who gives a price target on any asset, including gold and silver, who says it's going to be silver at $600 or silver at $350, I immediately back away, because no one knows. And I don't know, and no one does. I see, and I can say, as I've said for years, confidently that gold and silver will go higher than it is today. And as Rick Rule said better than anyone, and he's right, silver rewards infrequently but extravagantly. So if you're going to look at silver, first of all, to your point, understand its volatility. But you can measure that, you can stomach that volatility if you have a longer term view than just 1 year or 2 years. Silver is not an NVIDIA stock or Bitcoin. It's not going to get rich quick or get poor quick on one trade. You have to think of silver like you do of gold, as a monetary metal, a store of value, subject to greater volatility than gold. But in the next 7 to 8 years, as gold becomes part of the new abnormal, whether it's a global reset or whether it's trade settlement, it won't be a gold-backed sovereign currency, but gold will have a more fundamental role as collateral for loans, as collateral for repo markets in the East, as trade settlements among the BRICS and probably part of the central bank digital currency new normal that the IMF telegraphed during COVID, gold is going to be there. And when gold rises, silver will too. The gold-silver ratio now is not nearly at 80 what it was in 1980 or 2011 when it was at 15 or 32. I think there's going to be further compression in the gold-silver ratio and the Dow-silver ratio. And I think silver will go measurably higher. I will not say gold, I mean, silver's going to 350. Buy it today and you'll 7X and call me when you're rich. I'm saying silver will be worth more than 50 in the future. I think at a significant level, more than 50, never in a straight line. Gold, when it went from what, $35 to 850 in one decade, still halfway through, lost 25% in a year. Nothing goes in a straight line. But if you own it as a monetary metal, as a store of value, and as insurance against dying purchasing power, that ounce of silver is certainly more valuable than $10 in your wallet. What's going to happen to that? And so I'm just saying, on a relative basis, buy silver because it's affordable, it's undervalued, its compression with the gold silver ratio means it's going to go higher, its supply restrictions make it an obvious supply and demand investment. What's happening on the LBMA markets and the COMEX markets, there's just like a $38 billion float in silver, free float. That means available silver is just not there and the demand is there. And again, I could spend an hour on the wonky, sexy Wall Street talk of why silver makes sense, but for your listeners, there is a massive supply and demand mismatch empirically in silver. The control over silver on the COMEX is not what it was 5 years ago. And so the manipulation is not what it was 5 years ago. And the demand for it, from nuclear reactors to solar panels to, electronic batteries to monetary investors, the silver demand is much stronger than the supply. So I see silver as a great opportunity. Please hold it for more than a year or until it goes up 20 bucks. Hold it as a longer-term investment. I do not know what the top will be in silver. No one knows what the top is in everything, but you'll know when you get a certain multiple of your original investment that you can cash out, use some of that upside in silver, maybe to buy some gold if you can afford it, or just hold on to it and save in precious metals like silver and gold and spend in fiat when you can. Again, long answer to a short question, but because gold is very expensive for most listeners, silver is an affordable alternative, and it's not a stupid alternative. It is more volatile, but I think the upside is, in basic math terms and basic geopolitics terms, really very good for the listener.
Well, it's interesting to look at and consider silver playing catch up with gold, right? And how that has happened over time and through these different cycles. Over the last 2 years, I was just looking at it, the gold price has doubled over the last 2 years. But yet the silver price has only doubled over the last 2 years. So when we are looking at these charts, Matt, does it make sense that it's too late to buy silver or gold?
It's a great question. And the short answer is it's not too late. And again, well, that's a guy. He wrote a book on gold. He works in Switzerland selling gold and silver. Of course, he's going to say that. He's on the sell side. I've been on the buy side. I would say the same thing if I heard someone say that. So I get the cynicism. It's not too late for a number of reasons, in my opinion. But again, I caveat that by saying if you think the gold and silver only go in a straight line, and that's what I'm promising, that's not what I'm saying. There is volatility. First of all, in inflation-adjusted terms, even at $50 or $54, this is not an all-time high for silver. It should be at 150, 160 on inflation-adjusted terms, which was prior highs. And gold should be at 4,800. So even this exponential rise in gold and the slow catch-up with silver is nothing when you really measure it against actual inflation. So I think just on inflation-adjusted terms, it's going to go higher for that reason in general, not in a straight line. I also think the market cap for silver is the entire global market is less than half of Nvidia. It doesn't take a huge amount of demand to push silver up. Right now, precious metals, even in this bull market, are less than 1% of global allocations. The average of 2 to 4 to 5%, which we've seen in the past, even 8%, is coming. And when it comes to 4 to 5% and not 1%, just that demand on the retail side should push the metals up much higher, getting away from just the COMEX and the LBMA mismatch in supply and demand. When you look at the inflation adjusted, when you look at prior histories of gold silver ratio compressions, when you look at the still low demand for gold and silver, because for decades, Wall Street has pushed gold in particular as a pawn shop asset that's too volatile, despite the fact that gold has quantifiably outperformed the S&P for the last 25 years in terms of total return, and yet it was still too volatile. Only now are the banks, through no genius of their own figuring out that gold matters because their clients are finally seeing it and telling them, you need to give me gold. That's what's happening. They've been trying to intentionally misrepresent these two threats to fiat money as a volatile asset. And that narrative is not working. So I think when we go from less than 1% precious metal demand to 5 or 6%, that too will push the price up. So you have this perfect, in my opinion, convergence of a tightening supply of a precious metal whose demand is building up, and it's not even hit momentum yet. And so, no, it's not too late. It's not a top. Again, especially with gold, this is not a risk asset or a typical commodity. It's not even a typical hard asset. It is a precious metal, not a base metal, and it is a monetary metal. And because the monetary system is what's really at fault here, you need an anti-fiat solution. Many would say that's Bitcoin. That's a whole other hour. But certainly gold, even the Bitcoin crowd would agree that gold is one solution. And so it is going to move not like a typical chart pattern asset. It's going to move because the monetary system, we don't know exactly how it plays out, resets here, that's that, east, west. Whatever the new monetary system is, east or west, gold plays a huge component. And when gold rips, silver follows. Silver will play a component in that too. So no, it's not too late. Silver is just more affordable for most. And there is a seismic monetary shift happening. So the gold price is still, to me, in the first or second inning of a much longer game here. And again, even when you look at past cycles where you went up 1,500, 1,600%, our cycle right now is not that fast. Ironically, in percentage moves, is prior bulls. But even in other bull markets, gold and silver don't move in a straight line. You have to be a big boy or a big girl about volatility. The only way you'll stomach that volatility with any confidence is if you have an informed opinion on why you bought gold and silver. And if you're buying gold and silver, it's not a speculation trade. It's not for the next quarter. It is a preservation asset against openly dying fiat currency.
So
That's how you have to see it. Yep.
I'm sorry, Matt.
I said that's how you have to see it if you want to buy it, and buy it with a safe stomach and have the confidence to hold on to it through storms.
So on the, to oppose that view of gold and silver, you mentioned earlier that basically the equities that we're looking at, the Mag 7, for example, all these AI trades are basically priced for perfection. So how does the market price that for perfection? And how are those valuations of those companies also affected by the interest rates?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. It's a long question. First of all, will equities or stocks be a better hedge against inflation or risk than, say, precious metals? That's a fair question. And many would argue that as long as you have a dovish Fed or a money printing Fed, yeah, it's debasing the currency. But if you have a dovish Fed that's printing money and keeping rates low, these all-time high equity markets can continue to go higher, that they're effectively immortal. That is an argument that you should do your own research on. I'm a former risk asset guy. I'm a former hedge fund guy. I certainly was all stocks and bonds. I take the view of Jeremy Grantham that market mean reversion is a powerful force. I can certainly measure a bubble and track a bubble, but I can't time a bubble. And we are in a bubble for sure in general in equities, in tech, and everything else, certainly in tech. And we'll get to AI. To go into a topping all-time high by every valuation metric market as a safe haven, to me personally, is a riskier bet than a starting bubble in a precious monetary metal like gold and silver. So to me, it's a much safer bet to believe in the long-term preservation power and price direction of gold and silver than an already quantifiably dangerous bubble for which I cannot time or measure its collapse state. No one can. In terms of the larger risk that I see as a former trader, I see risk in subprime and private credit and certainly in AI. You've got this OpenAI and Anthropic, they're the talk of the town. I've seen this before. I saw it with ABS, asset-backed securities. I certainly saw it with tech stocks during the dot-com bubble in 2000, that this is the new future. And it certainly is a seismic shift, just like electricity was, just like the internet was. So is AI. It has massive advantages. It has massive power. And it has massive efficiencies. It's just overpriced. And OpenAI has $13 billion in revenues and is acting like it owns the world. And Sam Altman thinks he's gonna raise $1.4 trillion from his OpenAI to spend on more models. that's incredibly arrogant for a young jock like himself, a young tech geek like himself with 13 billion in revenue to say I can do 1.4 trillion. And when if you listen to his interviews, he basically implies, well, if I can't get it, the federal government, we're too big to fail. AI is so important. We need to have it. They'll back me. That's the same kind of arrogance a banker had in 2008. It bothers me. But beyond Sam Altman and OpenAI or Anthropic, in 2025, this year, there's been over $330 billion spent on AI data centers by the Mag 7 and some of the big tech companies that are holding the S&P up right now. They have a massive majority of the market cap in the S&P. So the whales, the monopoly-busting whales that were running the S&P and keeping it afloat are spending a ton of money on AI because they got to keep up with each other. But the companies making the spend are pricing in to cover that spend, they have to have annual revenues of at least $2 trillion to justify that spend. So they're pricing in perfection for AI, that every dollar spent will have an earnings generated profit. But these AI expenses are funded off the balance sheet. They're usually funded through private credit, SPVs, and circular financing, which I won't get into. It's wonky, it's Wall Street, but it's off the balance sheet. So they're spending like tomorrow is permanent sunshine, never a bad cloud, never a raindrop, never a thunderstorm. But that to me is incredibly typical of a pre-bubble disaster. And I've seen this movie before in tech. I've seen it before in subprime. I think that's why Buffett is billions in cash right now. I think it's why Michael Burry, I mean, Michael Burry is the joke. He's like, he's the guy who's called 30 of the last two market crashes. But, you know, but Michael Burry is so rational, so on the spectrum smart. He is a bellwether of when things are completely disconnected from fair value. And he's closing his fund and he's 80% short AI because he knows it's a bubble. He can't time it. And some of the smartest portfolio managers who were the most defensive and the most successful were the ones who closed their funds before a bubble because they said, I no longer can make sense of it. I know it's overvalued. I know it's going to blow. I don't know when. I'm done. And I'd rather be out of the game than get killed in the game. And I think that's a sign to me as well. Again, take it or leave it, I still trust Michael Burry far more than Sam Altman any day of the week. And even though Buffett's not a big gold guy, I trust his instincts on the equities far more than my own. So those are the things that Matt Pietenberg is considering. Doesn't mean you have to do the same, but that's my way of saying I think AI is in a bubble. It is a classic bubble asset. It doesn't mean that AI isn't interesting or revolutionary. But like all overbought, it will soon be oversold, and it's been overhyped to save this market. It won't. That's my view, yeah, on AI.
We always have to take this, let's say, this nuanced and balanced view of any of these things. You know, there are positives to AI, but there's also going to be these incredible negatives that come along with it. So I appreciate you know, the at least acknowledgement that this isn't just a black or white thing.
No, and believe me, the internet was a massive change in all of our lives. My life and your life is infinitely easier if we can just set up an internet cafe anywhere and do work from anywhere in the world and put up a, you know, an I have a Elon Musk satellite and take it out of my car and pull off on the side of the road and send out an article or do an interview. The internet has changed my life for the better. I'm glad it's there. I think AI can make things a lot better for a lot of people. There's a lot of other dark sides to it in terms of what it's going to do to employment. But I'm not saying AI is a scam. I'm saying it is like the internet stocks and the pets.com and all the dot-com stocks that I traded in the late 90s and into the crash of the NASDAQ. A lot of the AI memes and valuation terms and market terms are over-exaggerated. And I think that's a market risk. It doesn't mean that AI doesn't have a place in the world or that it isn't a fantastic opportunity in certain ways to be used, but it also has a far darker side in terms of its valuation and frankly, in terms of what it's going to do to a lot of white collar and blue collar jobs in the next 15 years. So that's a whole other topic.
Well, Matt, I think that's a good place to kind of put a pin in it for today. Is there anything that you'd like to leave people with to consider or to think about as we move forward through this time of extreme, you know, maybe that is the best way to put it, of extremes?
Listen, as I always say, and I mean it, is, and I'm not falsely modest. I'm not that modest at all in general, but I mean anything I can say, I do mean this. Get your own information, be skeptical of anything I say, be informed, be critical thinking, fact check, or dive into a topic, whether it's derivatives of the Fed or whether it's AI, anything that I've talked about or you and I have talked about today, if it raises an interest, whether it's gold and silver or the LBMA markets or COMEX, if it raises an eyebrow enough to think, I wonder if he's kind of onto something, do your own homework. Look at people who think the COMEX is great. Look at people who think that AI is going to solve everything. Look at people who think it's fairly valued. Look at other opinions. But get informed. Don't get emotional. These are my opinions based on my experience and decades in the space. I have high conviction. I am not a crystal ball seer, but I do have strong conviction, regardless of whatever you take away from this, is that fiat money is at an historical turning point. You have to protect it in some way. Precious metals are a historical solution or an analog solution. Bitcoin and crypto are another solution. I'm not here to laugh at that either. We didn't get into that, but get informed. That's my basic takeaway. Don't take my word. I'm not asking you to take my word, but at least take the topics that, Tom, that you and I have taken today and look into them for yourself. And don't just get angry or happy about what I'm saying. Look into it for yourself. Get your own opinion. Power of your own opinion and informed opinion is free. You don't have to be wealthy, left or right, white or black, American or European, to be informed. And I think that is far more important to me than the emotional kind of debates and criticisms we see in the space right now.
Really, really well said, and a perfect point to kind of end on for today. If
All
there's
right.
anybody that wants to read more of Matt's articles, those are all available at vg.gold, as well as Matthew Pippenberg on Substack, and of course, at Gold Switzerland on X. Matt, thanks so much for your time today. It's always a pleasure to speak with you.
Oh, my pleasure as usual. Thank you.